Lecture 21, Language Mixture, Grammar.
It's often said that married couples start to look alike, and they do. You've all seen that. It's often said that people start to look like their pets, and I have seen that as well. Languages are like that. When languages come together, or to be more specific, when people are bilingual between two languages often, generally those languages come to look more like one another, not only in terms of words, but in terms of the way their grammars work. So grammar mixes just like words mix, as we looked at in the previous lecture. This is something that happens most often when literacy is not widespread. So once we've got that artificial intrusion of the page and a sense that the language is the way it is, and most of the population is being exposed to that all the time, because language changes more slowly, in the same way, languages tend to be a little bit less receptive to that kind of changing one another in terms of grammar. So, for example, Spanglish being used on the page is something that will come far, far in the future, if ever. But before literacy was widespread anywhere in the world, this kind of grammar mixture took place all the time, and it had a major impact on why languages are the way they are today, not only in terms of words, but in terms of how they're built, how you put their words together. So with language mixture, there's words and there's grammar. This lecture will be about how languages share grammar. And remember that it's not that languages can share grammar. It's more languages share grammar. It's a default condition. There are not many languages in the world where we cannot very definitely pin down that they're affected by contact with another language in terms of their grammar as well as their words. So the stew is about structure as well as words. Simple example where the phenomenon is particularly clear is in southern Africa. And we looked a little bit at the Klik languages, which is a small and endangered family of languages spoken in southern Africa, surrounded by another group, the Bantu languages today. But the Klik languages are well known for, three guesses, click sounds. And the click sounds are not just expressive, they're actually as much a part of the sound system as B, P, D, L, U, and H. You have to be able to make these various sounds in order to distinguish between words. Now, that's a very rare feature. It is only, as I said once before, found elsewhere in one special version of language used to one's mother-in-law in one language in Australia. Other than that, nobody has clicks in their languages in the world except for this one family. Very, very rare, except that there are Bantu languages, completely unrelated to the click languages, that have some of these clicks. And so, back in the 70s in particular, 60s and 70s, there was the singer Miriam Makeba, and she used to sing in Xhosa, or actually Xhosa, although I'm rendering the click not well. And you would see her on TV, and she'd be singing with these click sounds. Now, because very few Americans, Xhosa is very good, I get the feeling that much of the joy that many bohemian sorts and people who were doing fondue and, you know, swinging and all the things they were doing at that time enjoyed about Miriam Makeba was just these clicks. I've seen clips of her as an adult, and there is something fascinating about those clicks. Now, she was singing in Xhosa, which is a Bantu language. It's closely related to Swahili. Bantu languages don't have clicks. They're spread throughout sub-Saharan Africa. They only have clicks when they border these click languages. So, given that clicks, for all intents and purposes, do not exist anywhere in the world except in this one family, in this one part of the world, the fact that languages like Xhosa have the clicks is clearly due to contact with click language speakers. Now, because most languages are not written, and even many that are written now were not written until rather recently, we don't know how that happened. We don't know exactly how another group of people started making those click sounds. We can assume that it would have been because of marriages or maybe something less pleasant like enslavement, but somehow people came close enough together that non-click language speaking people started making the clicks, or children were born into some setting where they were listening to the clicks being made and could learn to do them before their language capacity ossified while they were also learning the Bantu language. We can't be sure, but something like that happened, and as a result, Miriam Makeba's Bantu language had these clicks in it. So languages came together not only in terms of words, but in terms of grammar. Another example. And there are times when you can suspect certain things. Go with the hunch. I've talked about Indo-European now and then, and I've almost always referred to the Indo-European languages of Europe. But then there's the question of what put the Indo in Indo-European? And the reason that it's called Indo-European is because among the families of the group are languages of, for example, India. Also, Iran, there's a group of languages like Persian and its friends, but then there are the languages of India. And if you think about it, if you've had any experience with languages of India that are Indo-European, like Hindi, Gujarati, Bengali, Marathi, you are pardoned for thinking somehow these don't seem European. Even if you don't know anything about the languages, there's a sense when you hear these languages, this doesn't remind me of German, this doesn't remind me of Russian, or if you hear the accent of a person who grew up speaking Hindi, somehow that seems like a very, very different way of making sounds than what you associate with the European. The reason for that is that the languages of India that are Indo-European have been surrounded by or in close contact with very different languages for a long time, and that gives them a very different character. And it's not just that there's something funny about the accent or they're just weird. It's actually more scientifically that these languages' structures have signs of mixture from other languages. So if you think of India as a kind of upside-down triangle in a very schematic sense, then you can take the bottom third, very schematic, bottom third of the triangle, and then you take a teardrop, which is Sri Lanka, and that's down on the bottom of the triangle. You can think of it as the triangle is squeezing out a teardrop. That's Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka and that bottom third, they have languages that are of a different group called Dravidian. And so the ones that we encounter most are probably Tamil and Kannada and Telugu and sometimes Malayalam. Those are the big four, but in particular Tamil. If somebody says I speak Tamil, they do not speak a language related to French and German and Russian or even Hindi. Now those Dravidian languages, because they're a completely different family from Indo-European, have many very different structures. So, for example, in India, if you're dealing with a Hindi or a Gujarati, the verb comes last. That's something that's rather unusual in Indo-European. It happens. It's there to an extent in German, for example. But in general, a language that is SOV, subject, object, verb, is not something that Europe is too crazy about. But suddenly, it becomes the order of the day in India. So, for example, if you want to say, I met Apu, then the way it comes out in Hindi is I, Apu with, met. And so, me, Apu se, milata. And so, I, Apu with, met. Now, what's the verb doing over there on the end? Why would that happen? Like, you think to yourself, if a language is going along and it's got its verb in the middle, kind of the way we're used to, the boy bounced the ball, what kind of process of change would make people gradually start saying, the boy, the ball bounced? You imagine if anybody did say something like that, like if they were having a small stroke or something, you'd tell them to stop saying that. It's one of those things that would be a true mistake. If a little boy said, you know, the boy, the ball bounced, then you would say, stop that, Joshua. You're supposed to put the verb in the middle. There's no way that that would gradually happen. But it could happen if you have people who are in close contact with languages that have always put the verb at the end. So the Dravidian languages, like Tamil and Kannada, always have the verb at the end. And so, for example, in Kannada, if you want to say, he fed me a biscuit, then you say, he, to me, a biscuit fed. So, avanu nanage bisketanu tinisi danu. And suffice it to say that tinisi danu is fed. So they did that. Because of that contact, the Indian Indo-European languages started doing that too. And there are also implications there for the sound system, to the extent that these Indian Indo-European languages have certain consonants that sound exotic to the European ear. Much of this is due to contact with these Dravidian languages. So, grammars mix in this way. Now, the way this happens, from what we can see, is usually that a language comes into contact with another language. Language A comes into contact with language B. And gradually it gets to the point that some generation of kids start learning language A not completely, and they start adding elements of language B into it. In general, what happens is that the original language unravels a bit and leaves space for other things to flow in. And so you get a new kind of language entirely. We can see how this sort of thing would begin, although widespread literacy tends to kind of hold it back, with foreigners we meet today from very multilingual nations. And so, for example, it's often said that Africans often speak 7 languages, and they'll often tell you that they do. Now, a person can speak 7 languages perfectly well. That can happen. It's very, very rare, though. If you spend a lot of time with the villager who has come to the city and drives a cab and has a wife who speaks another language or something like that, if you really get down to the nitty-gritty, you notice after a while that of those 7 languages, 3 he speaks really, really well. Then 1 or 2, he really knows a lot of words and some sentences and some set expressions, but couldn't really have a conversation. And then 2, he speaks pretty darn well, the way a lot of us speak French and Spanish after having had a lot of it in school, things like that. And that alone is still wonderful, but it shows that it's very common in much of the world to have a command of more than one language, but that doesn't mean that you're going to speak all 7 perfectly. You're going to have some of them incompletely. Now, if the situation is that a whole lot of people start learning a language incompletely, that might start having an effect upon this language being learned incompletely, and other elements from all these other languages might start to flow in. That's the way these things happen. And so the world is full of this sort of incomplete acquisition. Take Australia, for example. There are these women who are brought from other groups and they speak other languages. Well, presumably they learn the language of their new group to some extent, but they're human beings just like the rest of us. Presumably they don't learn it perfectly. Then their children hear that language and they are hearing their mother's version of the village language, and their mother's version is not complete. She's using some of the words from her language. The kids hear that. These are the sorts of things that are happening around the world. The way we tend to learn languages, with a blackboard and poorly written textbooks and things like that, that's brand new. The idea of je suis, tu es, now recite after me, is not the way languages are generally learned around the world. And the way we're doing that now is a kind of a Western print slash educational revolution phenomenon. So that is a lot of how languages have mixed in this way. And it's an area of study that's increasingly important in linguistics. It used to be that linguists tended to not be crazy about the notion that grammars mix as well as words. But it's become very clear that actually grammars mixing is not exotic, it's a default, and there's more and more work being done on that subject. Now, there's some languages in the world, not a whole lot, but this does happen, and this is something else that linguists have become aware of, in particular over about the past 40 years. There are some languages that are so mixed that you can no longer call them a version of language A or a version of language B. They're just hybrids, kind of like a mule is neither a horse nor a donkey. And the way these languages begin, before we get to those languages, is with something that we are more familiar with. And this is something which is called code switching by linguists, but in the real world is often termed mixing the languages all together, and I know I shouldn't do that. But it's actually something that is common in the world. This is where speakers are regularly alternating between 2 languages in the course of a conversation. So, for example, what is sometimes called New Yorican. You can be in, for example, New York. And I remember when I first lived in New York for a little while in my early 20s, I would listen to Latinos in New York, and they'd be on the train, and they'd say a sentence and a half in Spanish, and then they'd switch to English and then to Spanish. And I remember before I was a linguist, I remember thinking it's really a darn shame that these people don't know either one of those languages well enough to actually stay with one. And I really, privately, I kept a journal at the time, and I wrote in my journal, there's this linguistic scourge in New York City, which is all these people who haven't learned either language well. I'm surprised no one's noticed it. And, of course, it had been noticed. It had been studied. And it was code switching. And actually, people like this speak Spanish and English equally well. And what they're doing is indexing a kind of bicultural identity. So if somebody in that setting wanted to say, why make Carol sit in the back so that everybody has to move so that she gets out? That would be an ordinary sentence. A person like this might say, why make Carol sentarse atrás para que everybody has to move para que se salga? You hear people doing that in New York all the time, back and forth, back and forth. And it's interesting. If you study it, you find that it has a grammar. You can't just switch anywhere. You can't switch in the middle of a word. There are certain ways you can tack endings on and certain ways that you cannot. It's very systematic. There's a whole cottage industry in linguistics right now trying to figure out precisely what the system is. I've seen friendships break up over disagreements over what the system of code switching was. In other words, it is a real academic topic. And it's done all over the world. It's not just Spanish and English, but it's generally between any two languages, especially where one is the dominant one in society, and then there's one that is loved more intimately. People will switch in between. People are doing it between French and Wolof in Senegal, for example. So it's a general phenomenon. And usually, the more intimate the switching is, so the more people are switching in the middle of the sentence, like, why make Carol sentarse atrás para que everybody has to move para que se salga? That indicates more of a bicultural identity than if people switch just between sentences. And so, to the extent that you see someone code switching, what you're seeing is somebody who is truly melting into the new society while retaining a part of their identity. For many people, that is considered the ideal thing. So code switching can be seen as healthy. But what code switching actually is, so much of what you see in the present is really just a step along the way towards something else. It's part of a climb. What that is the beginning of what can be a whole new kind of language. And that kind of language is demonstrated by one called media lengua, which is spoken in Ecuador. Ecuador was home to some men who grew up speaking Quechua. Quechua is an Amerindian language. And they grew up speaking Quechua, but they would go to the capital, Quito, and work. The language of Quito is Spanish, this being the official language of Ecuador. They developed an identity that was neither colonial Spaniard nor village Indian. It was something in between. And they developed a way of speaking that corresponded to that way of being. And what it was Spanish words plugged into Quechua grammar and used with the Quechua sound system. And it's called media lengua, middle language, because it's in between the two. And so, for example, if in Spanish you want to say, I come to ask a favor, you might say, vengo para pedir un favor. So I come for ask a favor. Vengo para pedir to ask a favor, un favor. Now, in Quechua, this comes out quite differently. And I'm presuming that probably not a single buyer of this set is a native Quechua speaker. And so we're not going to pretend. But can't teach Quechua now, but it's very different. For example, the object comes first. So the way the sentence comes out is, a favor, ask, come I. So that's the first thing to know, that the object comes first. Then you have shuk favor, that's favor. Then ask, the word for ask is manya. And then the word for come is shamu. That's cute. That'll stick in the mind. So shamu. So you've got shuk favor, manya, and shamu. Now, the twist about Quechua is that it's one of these Latin-like languages. There are all these special endings. Now, we're not going to worry about what the endings do, but shuk faburda manya ngabu shamuhuni. So we've got the shuk fabor and the manya and the shamu, and now we're sticking stuff on the end. So shuk faborda, manya kabu, shamu huni. That's the Quechua. Now, in Media Lengua, the way I come to ask a favor comes out is that it has the main Spanish words, the favor and the pedir and the venir, but then it has these endings from Quechua. So it's uno favor ta, pidi gabu, mini huni. Now, in addition, the sound system of Quechua comes into Media Lengua. And by sound system, for now, what I mean is that there's no E and there's no O in Quechua. So all you have is your A, your E, and your U. Your A, your I, and your U. So that means that if you've got a Spanish word like pedir, then in Quechua, it's going to come out as PD. And so that's the way it comes out in Media Lengua. Or venir will be vini, because there is no E in Quechua. So the sounds of Quechua are in Media Lengua. The word order and the endings of Quechua are in Media Lengua, but it's Spanish words. And what's important is that when Media Lengua speakers do this, it's not Pig Latin. They don't do it and then giggle. They don't kind of sit in a circle and play the Media Lengua game. They actually speak this way, and it's getting to the point where there's some people whose Quechua is fading, whose native language really is Media Lengua. So it's a language. These languages are sometimes called mixed languages by linguists, but that term is awkward because, as we're finding, all languages are mixed languages. Some Europeans have called them intertwined languages. I've noticed over 10 years that's not catching on. I think it's a little peculiar. The intertwined is just not a current enough word. It doesn't sit well on the tongue. Maybe you all can come up with a word for these languages, but they are these. It is this kind of language where there's this 50-50 split. Mixed languages, intertwined languages. Another example of an intertwiner, as I call them in my own head, is Miedny Aleut. Aleut is one of the Eskimo languages. Miedny means middle in Russian, so you may know what's coming. In the 1800s, there were Russian traders, and they colonized the Aleut Islands off of Alaska. And they brought some Aleuts to work along with them on one of the islands. It was called Copper Island. The traders and the Aleut women had children together. So you've got Russians and Eskimos on this island having these sorts of things go on. And the children felt neither Russian nor Aleut, but something in between. And so they came up with this language, which linguists call Miedny Aleut. So it's kind of middle Aleut. And it's this kind of interesting, elegant train wreck between the Aleut language and the Russian language, which are two massively complicated but thoroughly incompatible languages which somehow are together in this package. And so, for example, we can't learn Russian today, nor can anybody learn Aleut who's under the age of about, you know, who's over the age of about 3 months. But with Russian, just suffice it to say that if I say to you, I told you, then the way you say it is, the way you usually say it is, I to you told, and I'd say, Я тебе сказал. So, I to you told. Я тебе сказал. So, Я тебе is I to you, and when I say сказал, the ol is the past ending. So that's like ed, walked, or something like that. So, Я тебе сказал. Now, in Miedny Aleut, the way to say, I brought you a package is, Я тебе, so there's that I to you, and then Тибук укарласал. Now, that thing that I did was the Aleut verb to bring. It's укарласал, or something like that. But suffice it to say that just like you have Я тебе сказал, I told you, it's Я тебе Тибук укарласал, and there's that у. So you have these Russian pronouns, and you have that Russian past ending, and then package and bring are from Aleut. And that's the way it goes. And again, it's very systematic. It's not a bunch of people saying, let's mix up the Russian and Aleut, and linguists are going to come. It's not like that. It's very structured. And so, for example, there are case endings on the nouns. Those tend to be from Aleut. But then the verbal endings tend to be from Russian. This is from that. This is from that. And everybody speaks it the same way. Or I should say spoke it. This language is quite moribund, really dead. But there was that. There are many intertwined languages like this. There are various ones between Romani, the language that gypsies in Europe originally speak, which is the language of India, and various languages of the countries that they have inhabited. This is something that you see a lot of. So, those are mixed languages, intertwined languages. That is kind of language mixture extraordinaire, where, for example, in Miedny Aleut, you couldn't say it was quite Aleut and it's not quite Russian, or if you are going to say it's Aleut, it's one truly whacked out kind of Aleut, and these are unusual meetings. So, getting back to the biology, I've said that it was like a horse and a mule when grammars mate like this. But that implies that there's something exceptional about this and that the result is somehow broken. But that's not quite right. There's a better biological analogy. Lynn Margulis is a biologist, and she has been one of the people who's drawn the most attention to the fact that symbiosis, communal dependent living relations, has been more crucial to the evolution of creatures than we might think. And so, for example, plants, as has been long known, get nutrients from the fungi in their roots that process nitrogen for them. Without those, the plants could not live. Or cows have bacteria that allow them to digest their food. Take away the bacteria, the cow would fall over. Or even our cells, if you look at a cell, then there are these organelles inside, like the mitochondria that produce energy. It's been pretty much proven at this point that the mitochondria started out as free-swimming things that were separate, and then they developed this relationship with cells, what are now cells, and now they always live inside the cell, and there's no such thing as a free mitochondrion. But there's a symbiosis between what originally were two organisms. It seems that this is the way we should look at language mixture rather than it being about mules. Margulis actually puts it so well in one of her books, the biological aspect of this, that I should just quote her. She says, "In reality, the tree of life often grows in on itself. Species come together, fuse, and make new beings who start again. Biologists call the coming together of branches, whether blood vessels, roots, or fungal threads, anastomosis. Anastomosis, although less frequent, is as important as branching. Symbiosis, like sex, brings previously evolved beings together into new partnerships." So, in the same way, the world's languages can be seen as being tens of thousands of dialects that all have evidence of these sorts of symbiotic matings in the past. So Margulis describes this anastomosis as branches forming nets. And I find that that is the best way to imagine our bush here. Now, of course, it's kind of a strange bush because its branches keep growing together. But you can imagine that we have all of these branches and then they grow together and we have these hybrids. That's what language is actually like. Now, you've also seen, I'm sure, that it's very common for plants to overgrow. You know, I've had many houseplants where really it's just too much. They grow, you're happy, then they grow even more, then there are flowers, and the flowers fall all over the floor, and pretty soon the plant is trying to eat your cat. There are plants where you have to kind of keep them clipped. And you also have to clip your hedges. The language bush is the same way. And so languages have a tendency to do something that we could call overgrowing. And this is going to be the topic of the lecture following this one. But for now, keep in mind the basic metaphor of branches forming nets.